Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and telephone. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Here's a something to make you feel a little bit better this summer while you're sitting there reading a good summer book, hopefully with a hot, appropriate level of SPF smeared on your body and some very fit, muscled individual wearing tiny little shorts runs by and gives you a superior glance. Well, you can take comfort from the fact that a new study shows that strenuous exercise is as bad as no exercise. In fact, there is such a thing as too much exercise. The study came out of a collaborative study between the Mid-America Heart Institute and the University of Frederiksberg in Copenhagen, Denmark. And it looked at basically, pace, quantity, and frequency of jogging. They studied about 1,100 healthy joggers and about 4,000 non-joggers since 2001. And they've been looking at how much jogging they did, how much exercise they did. They controlled for the exercise. And they found a U-shaped curve between exercise and the risk of early death. So essentially, very high levels of strenuous exercise, like marathons, triathlons, Ironmans, are probably not as good for you as less strenuous activity. And what they found was that the sweet spot was basically light to moderate jogging. Light jogging confers a longevity benefit of about 6 years compared to no exercise at all. If you are a heavy runner, like an Ironman or a marathoner, then you actually have the same life expectancy as the complete couch potato who does not exercise at all. That's what a U-shaped curve means, is that if you draw it on a graph, the sweet spots and the high points in the middle, and on either side, the mortality is greater than in the middle. So what's the optimum? The optimum frequency was 2 or 3 times a week for an hour at a slow to average pace. So that was the lowest hazard ratio, the light joggers, defined as 2 to 3 times a week for 1 hour. So if you want to know, there you go. But of course, all of that trying to exercise and eat right and do all these other things for longevity, that may prove to be completely unnecessary because science marches on. And this could really be a game changer. So, you know, headline alert, because this didn't make the regular news. But I think it's really important. In studying a small roundworm, they like to do genetics research on short-lived animals. These researchers looking at C. elegans have found that there is a moment when you start to die. And they have located that moment in these roundworms and found the genetic switch that starts the aging process. And essentially, what happens with this genetic switch is that the cell stress responses disappear. Now, there's a thing called the heat shock response that's found in all animals. And it is essential for proper protein folding and cellular health. It's essentially a repair mechanism for stresses. And we're talking at the molecular level, primarily oxidative stress. So what happens is that the germline, the cells that are making up the eggs and the sperm, those cells, when the roundworm reaches sexual maturity, a gene signal goes out from the germline cells to all of the other somatic cells and turns off cellular repair, ensuring that now that the animal has reached the reproductive age, that it's going to die. And if we look at this genetic switch now in the roundworm, they can see it. So, of course, now that we have all of these wonderful genetic splicing tools, and I spent a whole show talking about that a couple of months ago, and that was the CRISPR-Cas9 stuff. But essentially, we can go in and cut out any gene we want, or put a gene in, for that matter. But in the case of removing genes, that's much simpler. So they went back to the C. elegans worm, and they removed the switch. And what they found was that they substantially, like, tripled the lifespan of these worms. Will it prove to be that simple? Well, it's scary if it is, because this is probably something we will have the technology to do, certainly in my lifetime. And this, of course, if you could make every human being, the whole 7 billion of us, immortal, would that be a good idea? And does the price of immortality, at least according to the biological hardwiring, the price of immortality is never reaching sexual maturity? So do we have, in 100 years, a planet populated by immortal Peter Pans? Well, who knows, but stay tuned. It's going to get interesting. So let's go to our first email. And this one from CJ, who is from the Pacific Northwest. Chronic non-allergic rhinitis and IgA deficiency. I'm a longtime podcast listener and KUSP supporter looking for advice about chronic non-allergic rhinitis. I was also recently diagnosed with selective IgA deficiency, which I believe is contributory. He's 28 years old and he's got a BMI of 23 following a recent 50-pound weight loss. Go CJ. So I'm going to abbreviate this very long and well-written email. He's had chronic nasal congestion and stuffiness for about a decade, and he's tried all sorts of the various prescription drugs, most of the things I would give him, the various antihistamines, the leukotriene antagonists, nasal steroids, and basically saw an allergist and got scratch testing and intradermal testing and tested completely negative. So then he got blood testing for IgE and tested undetectable total IgE and completely undetectable IgA. So we're looking at a person whose immune system is different than the rest of us, because no IgE whatsoever is really quite unusual, at least if in general medical practice. I'm sure allergists see this fairly often. So he was diagnosed with having IgA deficiency and non-allergic rhinitis and given some drugs which kind of sort of worked but were not covered by his insurance and were very expensive. So his question is, what can I do? And I did a little searching around on the web, CJ, and I actually sent you the article via your private email, but there are about 25% of people with chronic rhinitis who are negative IgE in their blood, but actually make it locally in their nose. And it can be picked up by doing nasal washes and then sending those for IgE and tryptase. And in a substantial subset of the population, they actually do have an IgE, an allergic issue, but they're not manifesting it in the bloodstream, just locally. You should give Nasochrome a try. Nasochrome is chromalin sodium. It's over the counter. It has to be sprayed in the nose 4 times a day, which, well, if it works for you, you will rapidly adapt to the hassle of this. Relatively inexpensive, and it is a direct mast cell stabilizer. So playing the odds, I'd say you have a 1 in 4 chance of responding to this. You may have already tried it, but since you didn't list it, I'll throw that out there. I also want to encourage you to play with your microbiome a little bit. There's a particular species of lactobacillus called Lactobacillus rhamnosus, which you can find all by itself. The company Claire, with a K, that I use for probiotics, makes something called Therabiotic 1, and that's pure lactorhamnosus at a decent dose in the mid-billions. Call it 10 to 15 billion is what you're looking for. That's billion with a B. For Lactobacillus rhamnosus, there are studies in children with eczema, adults with allergies. It downregulates the immune system. And while you are not manifesting IgE, I still think this could possibly work for you. I would put it in my mouth, not in my nose. Let the humoral response occur and see if you can downregulate that puppy. In the meantime, the nasochrome goes at the back end, stabilizes the mast cells, and hopefully will get you some relief. As far as nasal lavage goes, you had a question about that. Neti pots, I totally recommend these. If you are having a local reaction to something, it'll wash the something out, as well as some of the local reaction products that get released. So I got an interesting email from Shaul, my friend in Israel, and he wanted me to expound a little bit about cinnamon. Those of you who are regular listeners to the program may have heard me talk about using cinnamon in diabetics because it improves insulin resistance. And let's see, the issue about cinnamon, and you'll see this all over the internet, is that it contains a compound called coumarin. And coumarin is it's like warfarin, okay? It's a blood thinner, and it occurs naturally in plants. This was discovered because of something called sweet clover disease, which is basically when sheep and other grazing animals get into a pasture full of sweet clover and eat nothing but sweet clover for a couple of, I don't know, weeks, let's say, they can develop a bleeding disorder and have hemorrhage because they've poisoned themselves. Coumarin is also used as rat poison. So when you see, oh, cinnamon has coumarin in it, that kind of freaks you out. And then the internet is full of, oh, the European Commission has said that you shouldn't have more than 0.1 milligram of coumarin per kilogram of body weight in an individual. And that's like, oh my goodness, that sounds like we could get into milligrams fairly easily. Well, I went, and they've gone and limited the amount that can be found in flour and products at the EU. And I want to say that the European Union is very vigilant and maybe a little over-vigilant. That's a debate. But certainly, if they're making an error, it's that error in that direction about thresholds for products. That being said, if you do the math, the most common cinnamon out there is the Indonesian cinnamon. And the amount of coumarin you're going to get in that is 2 grams per kilogram on the average. So if you do the math, you could easily consume 500 milligram capsules of that cinnamon and not get anywhere close to the toxic dose that this conservative agency is talking about. So I really don't think that anybody's going to consume enough cinnamon to get into trouble. And I'm assuming that was Shaul's issue, although he didn't specifically state that in his email. Please email me back if I didn't get your question. Bree in Florida wants to talk about rectal fissures. Bree, how to heal a rectal fissure. I've had it for 3 months. Hydrocortisone and Promoxine cream did not help. Now using nifedipine gel. Don't want to have surgery. Bree, get thee to an acupuncturist. There is an acupuncture protocol that I personally have used. Clinical anecdote, not a double-blind placebo-controlled study. So the value of the information I'm about to give out would be a C or a D on a scale of A to F. All that being said, anecdotally, you can do amazing things by sticking a needle in the top of the head. It's like the old joke with the plumber and the hammer, which if you don't know, I'll let you look up. And the point is, if you know where to put that needle, you can do amazing things. And there are some interesting therapies for hemorrhoids, prolapse, and fissures. So I would try those before submitting to surgery. Also, of course, the usual suspects, stool softener, squatting, not sitting on the toilet. If nobody's told you that one, you need to know that one. Get a couple of blocks and you're going to build up your quads, but you want to squat. So you could put a couple blocks on either side of the toilet so that you're sort of perched above the toilet seat and not actually sitting on it. That does wonders for helping heal an anal fissure. So a little bit more about vitamin D. Sam in Missouri and David in Texas have questions. So first, Sam, I got checked for my vitamin D2 and vitamin D3, and my 25-hydroxy test shows that I have an 18 on my D2 and a 28 on my D3. Now, the 18 for D2 is on the high side, and the 28 is low. Total vitamin D is 46. He's worrying, he's wondering, should he worry about this? And basically, as a vegan, Sam's probably taking a good, some kind of multivitamin or other supplement to get that B12, and he's getting, probably along for the ride, some D2, which is the most common vitamin D that you'll find in your standard mass market vitamins. Vitamin D2 is ergocalciferol. It comes from it's a byproduct, essentially, of manufacturing of some of various drugs. And so there it is, free for the asking. It's a vitamin, so it can be packaged. And so it's a way to kind of recycle and divert something out of the waste chain. Not such a bad idea. Vitamin D2 is not identical to the vitamin D that you make in your body. That one is the vitamin D3. And so in general, it's maybe a little less bioavailable, a little less active, but for the most part, I think it's okay to have a vitamin D2 of 18, and I like that your total is 46, so you should relax. David in Texas had a level of 18 of his 25-hydroxy. Now, he lives in Texas and stays out of the sun. He started taking 50,000 units a week for 8 weeks, and then he started taking 5,000 a day. He's on his third month of vitamin D supplementation at high dose, and he's about to get a second blood draw. He's looking for the 50 to 70 range, and yes, that's where I would go. And then he wants to know, if I've gotten there, how do I bring the dose down? So you take that 5,000, and if you're looking, if you've gotten on 2 months of 5,000 units to the 50 to 70 range, I'd back it down to about half that much in the summer and basically the full 5,000 through the winter. I have not seen anyone get toxic on 5,000, but that's just anecdotal. However, the Institute of Medicine exhaustively searched the medical literature and said 4,000 for indefinite periods of time, we can't find anything wrong with that in any study. So I think we're definitely in the safe zone when we talk about 2,500 to 4,000. And I suspect that you'll have to tank up every winter, kicking up to the 5,000 to maintain yourself. And that's what I would suggest you do. And going now to Lillian in Colorado, I have a question about the safety of diatomaceous earth for human consumption. I'm reading that food-grade diatomaceous earth is an effective dewormer for many animals, including humans. I'm having a hard time finding out if this is safe. Can you shed any light on this? There are two types, one for pool filters, which is toxic, and one that is food-grade, used for deworming when taking internally. So I'm not sure, Lillian, what your goal is. Do you think you have worms? And if you do, I would certainly suggest you use a nice, friendly, smiling package pharmaceutical for your worms. Do not try to deworm yourself with diatomaceous earth. It is probably not going to work. There are various animal studies where they actually look at the feces of animals in the stockyard that came in with parasites and then were fed diatomaceous earth. And compared to controls, essentially, they could not find any clearing after 4 to 6 weeks of feeding this stuff. So either they weren't getting the dose right or it doesn't work. I looked for animal studies that showed that it did work. I had a hard time finding anything. Now, in terms of the safety of diatomaceous earth, this stuff you should not breathe. Now, even the food grade stuff, which is certified as less than 2% silica, that's still 2% silica. And workers at the plants that make the food grade stuff have to wear respirators because they are at risk for a lung disease called silicosis, which also happens to glass blowers and other people who are exposed to high levels of powdered sand. This stuff will essentially turn your lungs into leather. Not a good thing. So please wear a mask if you are going to take this stuff, but I don't recommend that you do it. We're going to talk a little bit about one of my favorite topics now, the microbiome. And this time we're going to look at evidence for the microbiome and the musculoskeletal system. So the notion that the microbiome might play a role in the pathogenesis of various musculoskeletal disorder goes back to 1965, when researchers found a link between what they then termed deviations in the fecal microbiome and an increased risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis. In 1984, scientists found specific colonic microorganisms, that is to say, a subspecies of Klebsiella, that cross-reacts with the human HLA-B27 antigen and may be a potential trigger. Actually, I'd say it's a fairly established trigger at this point, triggering the onset of ankylosing spondylitis, which is an autoimmune disease where you make antibodies against your own joints. Rheumatoid arthritis is another such autoimmune disease, and it probably is triggered, at least in some individuals, by Proteus mirabilis, and there's good data on that. So what's going on here with these rheumatoid arthritis issues is molecular mimicry. And if you do therapies with probiotics, you're going to disrupt the microbiome back in a good direction. You send anti-inflammatory signals, and there are at least a dozen studies looking at probiotics in rheumatoid arthritis and showing a reduction in the number of tender and swollen joints in individuals. Typically, we're using Lactobacillus species for that, although there was one study that looked at Bifidobacterium. And what they saw, and when you track this prospectively, what you see is that the good bacteria go up, the bad bacteria go down, and as the bad bacteria go down, you have reductions in joint pain and stiffness. And this is because the bad bacteria, let's call them the bad guys to be simplistic, have on their surface signals that the immune system interprets as suspicious characters. When there are suspicious characters in the neighborhood, the number of cop cars patrolling the street goes up, and the number of innocent bystanders that get pulled over and for a stop and frisk goes up. Well, you can think of the immune system like those police officers who are out there trying to find the suspicious characters, but sometimes make a mistake and either arrest or pull over an unsuspicious, innocent bystander. We've been hearing a lot about innocent bystanders in the news. This is innocent bystanders in the immune system. But unfortunately, the victim in rheumatoid arthritis would be your joints. Now, other studies have looked, and I found this fascinating, at osteoarthritis and found that if you combine Lactobacillus caseae and glucosamine, you change the microbiome substantially. And this change in the microbiome alleviates symptoms much better than either just the Lactobacillus alone or just the glucosamine alone. So there's some synergy going on. Gout is another musculoskeletal disease that's influenced by bacteria. Now, gout is caused by elevated levels of uric acid. And there are bacteria in the intestine that break down various amino acids, it's more nucleic acid byproducts, but inosine, guanosine, these things have to be broken down. And as they're broken down, they can get turned into uric acid by gut flora. If you give gut flora that do this quickly, you can change how much uric acid is produced by the person, and you can basically prevent the development of gout in animals fed a high purine diet. So if you break down the uric acid in the gut, then it doesn't get absorbed. The purines don't get absorbed. The animal's kidneys and liver don't have to process them, and you don't end up with gout. So probiotic therapy for gout may be effective in individuals who are prone to it, might be a preventative. There's also really fascinating evidence for probiotics and bone health, specifically osteoporosis. And I really am keyed into this because we women worry about becoming osteoporotic and breaking our hips and damaging our bones. Well, it turns out that the fructooligosaccharides, the prebiotics that are digested by the good bacteria, turn into compounds called short-term fatty acids. And these are acids. So in the colon and the small intestine, these acids actually help with mineral absorption. They keep the minerals in solution so that the calcium and the magnesium can be absorbed. Studies showed that by an unknown mechanism, these probiotics also significantly elevate serum levels of vitamin D. And we don't know how that works, but wow, isn't that fascinating? So in a mouse study, they took mice and fed them Lactobacillus reuteri for 4 weeks. And then they took out their ovaries and looked at how long it took them to develop osteoporosis. And what they found was a substantial protective effect from the lactobacillus. Essentially, the osteoclasts, the bone breakdown cells, were suppressed really a lot. And so the osteoporosis didn't develop, and the animals were protected. Now, this was actually an increase in femur strength by 8.6%. So really interesting stuff going on in the way that bacteria feed into the musculoskeletal system. And you know, it's just going to be more and more, all right, where as we start to examine the microbiome and this complex bacterial physiology that's going on constantly, basically transforming what we eat into chemical signals, into substrates that we can use in our physiological processes, into things that can harm us or help us, that can talk to the immune system, upregulate it, downregulate it. This dialogue, this communication we've just basically discovered that we're talking to our bacteria and they're talking to us. And now we have to learn the language. And every time we look, we find an interaction. Everywhere we look, we find synergy and feedback loops. We are not a bag of human cells. That's not who we are. That's not what we are. We are a mixed colonial organism. We are a coral reef. And just like the fish clean the coral and the coral feed the fish, we have this amazingly complex dynamic going on that can be disrupted by new-to-nature molecules, that can be disrupted by adverse environmental inputs. And it also helps protect us and helps keep us whole. And we need to learn how to garden ourselves. That's what it's going to be. It's going to be, think of yourself as a garden and do the soil amendments and do the right fertilizers and understand the delay factor. You know, you do something in the winter and you don't get the fruit of it until the fall of the next year. That's how things really work in biology. Not this take the pill and 12 hours later you have an effect. Yeah, you can make that happen. But in the long run, that's not feeding your garden. We had an off-air question. Woman is looking for nutritional advice for stimulating hair growth. Is hair thinning caused by hormone changes? You bet it is. Primarily testosterone, which gets converted to dihydrotestosterone in both males and females. After menopause, testosterone levels fall in some individuals more than others. And that's associated in men with male pattern baldness and in women with a diffuse thinning. Women who get this generally have a family history on their mother's side of male pattern baldness. Biotin is helpful for strengthening and thickening thinning hair. So I would try 5 to 10 milligrams of biotin. Whenever you take high doses of one B vitamin, it's important to take at least supplement level doses of the other B vitamins. These are all water soluble vitamins. And so for most of us, our system is capable of kind of balancing it out. But you don't want to give yourself a whole bunch of one B vitamin if you're even potentially deficient in the others, because you can run into trouble. And we're going now to Karen in Soquel. Hello, Karen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to follow up on your call a little bit on nasal issues you were talking about. Well, maybe not. I have some allergies and asthma issues, and I was wondering if you could recommend any supplements, because I've gotten older. I'm a 53-year-old female, and it seems like I was able to control my they've gotten worse as I've gotten older. That is the asthma. I was able to control it with albuterol, whatever the nasal.
Yeah, albuterol.
But I can't seem to do that anymore. What happens is I get these episodes where it gets critical, and then I have to go to the doctor, and I end up going to the doctor or urgent care about every other day for 3 days till they can control it, and I have to get, you know, steroids and get the big, you know, the breathing treatment, calm it down, and then my question is it possible to try to do preventative or nutritional issues to strengthen the immune system or so that I can prevent these extreme episodes that I seem to have gotten about every year and a half since I've turned 50?
Well, yeah, I think there's a couple of things to look at here. We've been talking during this show about the microbiome and its influence on the immune system. So one of the things that you can do is exploit that. Lactobacillus rhamnosus, I already mentioned, maybe 10 to 15 billion. It does, at that dose, calm down the allergic part of the immune system. And there are studies looking at asthma. So definitely going on a lactobacillus rhamnosus formula. And, you know, you may want to start eating more fermented foods like sauerkraut or yogurt with active cultures, just on general principle to sort of provide substrate for the microbiome. We like to give things that they like to eat. And so kiwis are a really good source of a compound called inulin, and also jicama. So if you can put jicama in your salads every day, that would help actually keep the probiotics alive. And that's what you're wanting. You're wanting to garden this intestine of yours. There's a drug called Monolucast, which is oral. And I use this a lot in my asthmatics because it's a simple pill. It is very safe. It doesn't have a lot of it doesn't mess with anything that you need. Let's put it that way. It lowers levels of leukotrienes, which are an inflammatory signal that kind of that keep the fire burning. And it seems to me that if you're having these episodes once or twice a year, is what I heard, that there's a trigger. And that trigger could be a viral respiratory infection or something like that, or it could be an environmental trigger. And by environment, by the way, also means stress. So when you have these attacks, you know, think about what happened the last 24 hours, and was there some strong emotional event? You know, if you're one of those people who gets asthma attacks in response to that, or allergy attacks in response to that, then you are one of the people who's going to benefit from mind-body therapies as a kind of immunization against these surges in your system. Do you simultaneously get what feels like a cold before your asthma attacks?
Well, the problem is I can't always tell the difference between cold and asthma. Yes, I mean, in the sense of worn down, I get worn down and tired, and then it's always like, is it a cold or asthma? And then it's hard to tell the difference. So that's the problem.
There may not be a difference. It may be that the cold makes the asthma happen for you. Do you have a peak flow meter?
Yes. Here's the issue. I've tried to use that, and I calculated my average levels, and I think the problem is every time I'm not feeling good, I try it, and I think I cough or push harder, and I get myself to the level where I was at, and I go, see, I must be doing okay, but I'm not doing okay. So I think I fool myself.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Maybe a different actual shape device. I don't know how you could fool yourself. I mean, if you cough into it, then do it again without coughing into it, because it needs to be an exhalation that's like a normal exhale, not a cough exhale.
Well, I'm sorry, I probably misstated. I can get myself to exhale to my levels where I think it's normal, but I probably don't realize I'm pushing a lot harder than when I'm, you know.
No, but then what's happening, I think, is that you're not really using a good personal best baseline, because it has to be a full effort.
Yeah.
And then once you've done that full effort really reliably and you average it out over, say, 2 weeks' time, that's your number and that's your benchmark. And if you fall below 80% of that number, you're starting to head downhill and it's time to intervene. But that's why, you know, go on the Montelukast. That's a daily thing. It's now available as a generic. It's not dangerous, and it could really help with not letting I always like use the metaphor of a field of dry grass. Okay, you've got a field of dry grass. That's not a problem unless somebody, in this lightning strikes it, or somebody throws a cigarette into the field, and then you got trouble. So,
right. Is that something you take year round, or just when you think you're getting the, you know?
Year round, all the time, because what you're doing is basically wetting down that field of dry grass every day, because randomly someone's going to come by and throw a cigarette into it, and as long as it's wet, you won't get a brush fire.
And you don't get immune to it, like allergy medicines? Resistant?
Nope, you don't get resistant to it.
Oh, okay. And my last question is, how do you tell, every time I go into my doctor, they say, well, they give me the antibiotics because they can't tell if it's viral or allergic.
No, that's not why they give you the antibiotics.
Oh, okay.
No, they give you the antibiotics for consumer management because they're running a business, and because you're in an urgent care and you're paying them, what, $75-$80, and you expect to walk out with a prescription.
Right.
And they're not going to see you again. They don't have they're not set up to call you the next day and the next day and the next day to make sure you're not getting worse, which is
right.
what you should do in this circumstance, because most of the time you're not going to go into you have asthma, and so they're just covering all the possible bases, but for the most part the antibiotics are futile, but they're done.
Right. And so that's what I keep saying is, the problem is then if I'm on antibiotics and a steroid and an inhaler, I don't know if that's overkill to take the antibiotics and the steroid.
You know, and it depends on how severe your asthma is, because we're talking about a disease that kills people. My grandmother, my great-grandmother on my mother's side, died at 40 of an asthma attack. This is a potentially lethal disease. And you can't mess around with something like that. On the other hand, we do probably over-treat the attacks,
right.
But that's a brief over-treatment, and you can recover from that.
Yeah, but you say better to err on the side of caution in this case?
Better to err on the side of alive, but,
yeah.
You know, admittedly, once there is a penalty. If you take a burst of steroids twice a year for 20 years, you're going to have much thinner bones than if you didn't. So, you know, that's why I'm saying clean up your microbiome. You know, try to figure out what the triggers are. Take something that waters down that dry brush field. And I really think that you can improve things. And where do you live?
Monterey.
Okay. So if you can't figure out how to do those things down there in Monterey, you can drive up to Santa Cruz and see me and we'll work with it. But the important thing is this strategy that you've got of just like dropping in the urgent care, you're going to get kind of Burger King medicine, because that's what we do in urgent cares. And when I'm doing urgent care, which I don't anymore, but when I did, I did the exact same thing, because you're there just to keep the person from crashing. You're not really there to work with them on prevention. You're not, that's not your role, and that can't be your goal in that setting. And so if you go, you know, if you go to, think about buying clothes, right? If you want a beautifully tailored outfit with, you know, that's bespoke and that, you know, totally fits you, you're probably not going to go to a t-shirt store, because that's not on the shelf. The t-shirt will cover you and keep you from getting arrested for indecent exposure, but it may or may not, you know, flatter your form or fit all that well. See what I'm saying?
So yeah, that's good.
Go to the right store for the kind of medicine you need, and the urgent care ain't it.
And then Montelukast, is that a steroid or just a small amount of steroids?
It's not a steroid at all.
Oh.
It's a leukotriene inhibitor, and it is a very safe agent, not a steroid.
Okay, great. So there's no other flaxseed oil or any other anti-inflammatory?
All kinds of things that are helpful. I mean, fish oil at, you know, high doses, we've talked about that enough. But in terms of approach here, you could also try, by the way, an elimination diet, but you're not having frequent enough attacks for your, you know, once or twice a year, that you're going to see a benefit from these sorts of treatments. It's going to be hard for you to stick with them, unless you just take it on faith.
All right. That sounds like great advice. I'm going to try it.
All right. Good for you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And that's Lactobacillus rhamnosus. I'm going to spell it for you because it's weird. R-H-A-M-N-O-S-U-S. Let's go to Gina in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gina.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for your wonderful program.
Oh, you're welcome.
I am 65, and I have full-blown osteoporosis, apparently all over. I went on alendronate, 70 milligrams once a week, mm-hmm. and for a five-year program. I'm 1 year into it. But my teeth are, I'm losing bones, so my teeth are getting loose. And I know I'm not supposed to have dental work for the while I'm on this program.
It depends. You're basically not going to heal a dental implant.
So I'm just waiting on that, and I'm doing just really conscientious preventative care.
Are you on vitamin D? What is your vitamin D level?
Vitamin D, I am taking, let's say, 2,000 units a day.
What do you have a blood level?
E3. The doctor took it, but I don't know it.
All right, so you can get your number, and your number, you're shooting for about at least 50. Okay, and if it's 32 or something like that, you'd benefit by taking more vitamin D. But you should always monitor blood levels. When you're taking levels of vitamin D above 4,000 a day, you probably want to get a blood level a couple times a year and make sure that you're not getting up above 100, which is...
Okay.
No, people don't get into trouble below 100, but above 100, there can be some liver toxicity and some other things. So that's number one.
D3 should I be taking?
Well, I think you should be taking enough to get your blood level to 50. Often people will use 5,000, 4,000 or 5,000 a day, and after 2 or 3 months, check a blood level and see where they've gotten.
Okay.
And that's documented. Some family practice doctors did a study where they looked at how fast does it come up, and it takes a couple months, and that dose is sufficient to raise levels slowly, and slowly is what you want to do with a hormone. You don't want to slam a hormone into your body once a week. The vitamin D, 50,000 once a week, I really worry that that actually turns off the bone production and turns off calcium absorption. There are some preliminary data. So, you know, 5,000 is okay, 50,000 not so okay.
Right.
And then, of course, adequate calcium, adequate magnesium, vitamin K2, which you need to absorb the calcium also, along with the vitamin D. So a good bone.
Magnesium and zinc.
Yes, boron, and you need some boron as well. And, maybe a little strontium. You can find those in some of the health food store formulations. But you really want to maximize this. You got to do some weight bearing exercise. You know, 50 jumping jacks a day. How bad is your osteoporosis? Do you have a T score above -4?
See, I don't know the number.
You should also know your number, because there's osteoporosis and there's osteoporosis. One last question for you: did any of the women, grandmothers or mothers, have the fracture?
Yes.
Okay.
My mother.
All right. So if you got a fracture in the family, then the number is more predictive of risk than if you don't have a fracture in the family.
Yeah.
Okay.
My mother and her mother.
All right. So you are at risk. The fact that your teeth are a problem is a problem. Definitely keep that gum hygiene.
Yes.
That's you be squeaky clean on the flossing and the scaling and all of that. You've got to keep the bacteria out of there.
Okay. What was that last number that I needed to know?
Your vitamin D level and your T score, T, capital T score, and that's from your bone scan.
Okay, and what should it be?
Well, the question is, how bad is it? So if it's minus 2.5, you have minimal osteoporosis. And if it's minus 4, you have big-time osteoporosis. And if you're minus 4, I don't even recommend jumping jacks, because I'm worried that you'll jump yourself into a hip fracture. If you're minus 2.5, then jumping jacks are great, because that plus the alendronate may get you to a minus 2.0 in a couple years.
Yeah. Okay, and I have one question about artificial sweetener.
Yes, go ahead.
I consume quite a lot of it. And with limeade, I make fresh lime.
Which one are you using?
Let's see.
Is it the yellow one or the blue one or the pink one?
Yellow.
It's the yellow one. Okay. I love that they've color-coded the... Yeah, it's... Okay, so that's Splenda. Nice from many... In many respects, messes up your microbiome. So if you're taking large quantities of this, you probably are having an adverse effect on your gut flora. We already covered that good bacteria in your intestine actually help your mineral absorption. And they also turn down the cells that break the bones down after menopause. So we know that in rats. Maybe it's true in humans as well. So I'd be taking some probiotics at this point and maybe some of that inulin stuff I was talking about, because that'll get converted by the probiotics into these short-chain fatty acids, which will then help your calcium be better absorbed.
Yes. So I do take the probiotic Acidophilus every day.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I prefer a mixed form of probiotics with more than one species, but hey, that's better than nothing.
Okay. And is there any other suggestion you would give?
Let's see. What have we talked about so far? Vitamin K, boron, strontium, calcium, magnesium, weight-bearing exercise, vitamin D, dental hygiene. No, I think we covered it all.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Quick one from Jan in Capitola. Just listened to your interesting talk on the functional medicine approach to diagnosing a problem. Where do we find docs like you? I'm a senior on Medicare and I'm a member of one of those senior medical plans. I think you mean a Medicare Advantage plan. I'm sure they do not use a functional medicine approach. You're right. Medicare actively discourages a functional medicine approach, both in terms of their payment structure and how and what they require in the way of testing. If you go and look, it's so ironic. If you go and look at the original Medicare charter that goes back to 1965, and you're old enough, if you're on Medicare, you're old enough to remember when Medicare was being talked about, although you would have been maybe in your teens. Anyway, bottom line here, the Medicare charter says we do not pay for preventative care. We are going to pay for disease care. And you know what? They created a monster, because what we have is we have a fantastic disease care economy funded by effectively tax dollars, ultimately. So we've got the disease care industry, man. We've got that down. The problem is disease care actually has its own internal limits in terms of its ability to increase lifespan. Because preventing disease is actually much more cost-effective than treating disease. And we don't have any funding for prevention. And it's specifically excluded from Medicare. So whenever I'm ordering a test, I effectively need to come up with a justification that will satisfy Medicare. And yet, the truth may be that I'm ordering this test because I want to see what the vitamin D level is so that I can prevent the person from getting osteoporosis, but prevention of osteoporosis is not a legitimate reason to check a blood test. It's kind of a crazy, crazy system. And we have perverse incentives. Just as my mama would say, we have problems up the yin-yang. And indeed, we have. Real quick, we'll talk about prostate cancer and a big change that's happened in the last couple of years. So if you look at the number of men back in 1990 through 2009 who had low-risk prostate cancer, who didn't get surgery and didn't get radiation, you'd find it was less than 10%. Now, these men, low-risk prostate cancer, probably didn't need anything. And in the last few years, we've actually gotten some sense about this, and now we do something called active surveillance, which means you do blood tests, you ultrasounds, and maybe a prostate biopsy every couple of years. And as long as the disease is staying low risk and not progressing, you leave it alone. And you just let it sit there, sort of an uneasy truce, like North Korea and South Korea. You know, we stop the war and we just keep an eye on them. And that's essentially working really well for prostate cancer. We're up to 40% of men getting with low-risk prostate cancer just doing active surveillance. And so far, no difference in outcomes, and in fact, a slightly lower death rate, because all of those surgical interventions had some fallout, what do they call that? Ancillary damage, collateral damage, I believe is the military term. Let's go to Jack in Salinas. Hello, Jack.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I have several questions today I'd like to ask.
Okay, we've got about 6 minutes, so go for it.
Okay. So, first off, I took your recommendation on the L-arginine for the sinuses, because I've been having sinus problems for years, and it seems to be getting worse. So ever since I started taking it, you know, to increase the blood flow.
Vasodilate. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. So basically I'm taking it combined with fulvic acid.
Okay, fulvic acid doesn't ring a bell for me, but go ahead. Maybe acid, so, F-O-L-I-C?
No, fulvic acid. It's got a lot of trace minerals in it.
All right, well, so, go ahead. What's the question?
So anyway, that one is, since you don't know about fulvic acid, we'll worry about that. And then so on probiotics, I'm taking the seven senior specific strains, 34 billion cells. My question is, should I use this before I eat food or not? Is that a good dose?
Okay. Really hot food will probably have an effect on the probiotics. So if you're drinking really steaming hot soup or something, maybe wait until that's cooled down to body temperature before you throw the probiotics on top of it. Aside from that, most food and probiotics play very well together, and there's not a problem. If you take them on an empty stomach, you may get a little bit better absorption, because some of it, and that depends on the capsule, the specific aspects of the capsule, the probiotics you're taking. But you essentially need to get the probiotics through the stomach without dumping a bunch of stomach acid on them. Buffering right. with food is helpful, but also just taking it on an empty stomach can work. And I've never seen comparative studies, but this is all kind of theoretical. I don't think it matters that much, because it turns out, alive or dead, the probiotics still benefit you.
Okay. So what do you think about the 34 billion?
I think that's about the right number for maintenance. The one I typically use is 25. I think the compound that you might be talking about is fulvic acid, F-U-L-V-I-C?
Yes, that's it.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So this is basically not something that I'm particularly familiar with. I'm just kind of scanning what possible benefit one might be. It basically is an alkalinizing agent, so it may be in there with the idea that it's supposed to help alkalinize the system. And
right.
I'm not finding anything on Google Scholar that in human use that shows benefits. I think maybe it's supposed to help support probiotics. It's an entity that's found in organic matter as it deteriorates. So I think possibly it's a prebiotic of some kind, but I'm not really not really clear on what it's supposed to be doing for you. I'll try to come back next week with more information.
Okay, thank you so much. And I have one question that's just been driving me crazy. It's about someone. I use flaxseed, and I recommend it to everyone that I know. I do 2 tablespoons a day in my grain smoothie, and they said, Dr. Oz said you have to put it in the oven first. And I'm like, I don't understand that. Can you explain that to me?
Toasted versus raw flaxseed. I think they're probably shooting for increased bioavailability, and I'm not sure where Dr. Oz got that one, so I can't comment to say that, you know, what the superiority is going to be. But when you when you cook things, you change the molecular configuration, and sometimes it makes things much easier to absorb. There's compounds, for example, in tomatoes that are great for your prostate, but it's only in cooked tomatoes that they're in a form that your body can get them into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So that those are lycopenes. So, probably the gist of it.
Okay. So we won't go on because I haven't been able to find that. The other thing,
real quick,
my mom
now.
Told me, so I believe my mom. The last one is I put my mom on cholesterol medicine.
Uh-huh.
She's 85 years old. She had a cholesterol, total cholesterol of 165. She's now, as far as I'm concerned, exhibiting symptoms of pre-diabetes, which is if she drinks a glass of orange juice, she's having low blood sugar episodes. Can you enlighten me on that?
I see. If a woman is on a statin at 85, you need to talk to the doctor. Statins are associated with cognitive problems. They definitely increase type 2 diabetes, particularly in women after menopause. And at 85, if she was going to die of a heart attack, she can't die of a premature heart attack at 85.
Yeah.
And there's an inverse correlation between longevity after 75. The higher your cholesterol, the longer you live. All right.
Wow.
We're in this weird head trip where it's malpractice if you don't treat a cholesterol of 201, and it's nuts. You know, it's wow. Back when penicillin was given. We're back where penicillin was given for every sore throat, because that was the expectation. Now the expectation is that everybody's on a statin, and
How can I get her off of it? How should I wean her off of it if, you know, her doctor? I told her to go to her doctor and talk
I can't,
to her doctor.
You know, I can't okay. tell you to
okay,
disobey
so the
doctor her doctor.
Okay.
You know,
I
think you should get into the doctor's face and say, show me a study that any 85-year-old woman ever benefited from a statin. I got to go.
Very frustrating.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call. We're coming to the end of another hour, and I've really enjoyed it. Thanks for your calls and your emails. And I hope you'll join me next week for more Ask Dr. Dawn. So long, and stay healthy.